From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Archive Edition, comic and actor Ben Stiller. He's now starring in the comedy Flirting with Disaster. He plays an adopted son searching for his birth parents. Ben Stiller's parents are the comedy team of Ann Mirror and Jerry Stiller. Last night, William Link was inducted into the TV Hall of Fame. Link co-created Murder, She Wrote, Mannix, and Columbo. We'll hear from Link and from Columbo's star, Peter Falk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Nishomni, Sui, Noid, Ergil Bafonishan, but no Gerkma. Yelmaf Surf and that, and his earth with Snagus Therf, Nikamil Noan, the Ball Lord of Fernas Yarosh Nibit. Gil Scanary Hill of Nidosh, the Nimoth, who yet a knob by the Wahing Ebra, the Erk Nivesnith of Rose Lorg. Yelmaf Sinat and his earth with the Spirit Elling and Therfnis, Bell of Rescilam, the Yarosh Nidus Saranibet, the Orsh Nis Lorgoring East Yerthus. Mr. Astor, you couldn't get ever from that. Professor Sky, you couldn't get him now. You both the coughs didn't get him. The must and see and eat and the nest those dogs, some in the bowers and milk, Nizer.
Nesting is home to yell, he is not. He is the new Nesser, do not hot the other fashion, I sing it, I guess it. Now, Nick is the new minute. First guy, Fitness of Ralphie, now, Neil was the ashes that fish, the either from zero, this earth sky. Or at all, and the anal stop be from under the earth. So, this exercise child with Nesser, be off, I but emphasizer, sir, sir. Snicker, and Murdo, and I'm not missing you, can get lines, it's lost him, yes, so if they see this sky, and so I think I said, be suiting the lost the yellow, but Nesser be 50 with either, and I shall I boom its mom's lost him, sir. For these suits are all lost, so we've been nestled now near the end of the sand, and it ends sky having a digger and her lost homes. Now, I'll get to the from zero this and the snapper from ocean exceeds the drifts and the vessel shift. For I was nicking on the seas and then the couch, and I get them regards and so well, so I'll let me come to the door for folks all seem as the second earth and can all do not hear with the enlarged sail.
Still for real, he gives her even it. Well, my thought knows life for each child, it offers the sexual seam, but remind the vessel shift the thought never right. And the shoes gets hard from her feast and even if I give her all ear for getting sniz a quail out. Fan and I can think it's nip tan by scale of the thoughts I see in her to saw in your sister. Say I get the rest and call with her or now go snatched up snow elf and it was now as a scale of an eff my escort if a riddle and observe it male kids or Sam said Miss Snake is garish on a mirk about how do you got loves her old see. Yeah, just an ass nominate or court if an eef will a week sniz a crowd eef kept us her mob and eef. So in your eef net wasting and celery. Still fat and old fuzzy, this off my cat's hand at the calmer like the way in the near air she van at the age 50 and a valve and a slight valve, this old fat and a skis fuzzy, your valor sudden snows died in their eyes that they're slow not. My sister woke up lock, get home to the F, sister from it. Oh, as you need, sir, that really has had her saying you love with an admiral, see, yeah, just my broken neat dance in his grove. My ass to the late Elon Emerson, no, we down east down this valley, nor at guessing his wife, but she can see her over him with her in the valley for such Sarah and a good look at him. Nigga Shim can't off in the east grove, cause your cause will ours now, so it's this is it that.
Well, the service neat, her and Elmer as is it. See it, valley for open it, well, the soft of them of us, the issue again, you know, scissors over both, here, you're a heat for us in the mouth, none of it. On about fastener off. See, 80 minute off me off in the shoulder service set. Last night, you're there, you know, you did or say. Now we get up to get something to get and it's neat. Yeah, was there, you're not here with the assistance, she's a mistake of her off, the cellar with the lips of his, yeah. See, now you know, I just said, say, no, for the string is neat. Oh, I'm so sure failures. She's a mad girl, she's neat when soft, get them to see real legs, or she's neat, and I'll stick over, she's stick over, resting at home, said. Why, I'm saying, they're on this mistake of her, she's stick her off, it's in this neat, we're killer, get some else. All of the cash, I was doing this neat, over there, so she failures. Sure, though, if you know when it's all over here, it's nearly still alive. I had to know about this, and she's a full of the other office, and the elf miller's it.
Well, the sewer is more stroke, but now, where is our evening? None of Elner thus in the save. Now, we get our slash, Tassus, and the Yves, the student, the Hadlock, the Sir Ophel, our Zerus, fat head, that's the save, the loves the head, it kept us, and us, the air, rest, and Moser, the hilarious it. Peter, some of the Homer from your offer, no dog, the elves are evening.
They are in my field with a spell with a spell gap, but there is negative, and it's a stress to the zoo of life. My Venus and my good with the zoo of me laughing, the zoo of Albus of the snow, and that, but you know, that's only a few bucks, but That's just what they are. They are the looks of all the firm of the law, and not us, your mouth gap, but nap. Yeah, so then up in the lifestyle, but there's a rivers in the dark, so it was a remedy lamp.
Dark's jaw lowers the number of acids, that's no good deal, sir, even it.
Snizzer bread, remember in the leaf. He wait. Sa amarfanog. He'll kiss it for you. Snow double ships, right? Here, Mimni, it'll heal. No, Mom, Sydney. Hi, and what's next?
Her name's Gillan Osner, her Ralph Deller, her birthday, her Bible, beef, Loif, he's her going, you know, with Vinny, her mouth, with that, her voile off, beef, set by skiff, her seal, door, no, you know, word of her, with Vinny, mob, and no, I agree, you know, go beef with the steer, for no, snick, I stay, it's just, there's nothing else working, you know, with my last life, he does, him, a hook, but no, Gerk, man, this, you shall, when you know, you there, give up on a shammer.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dow Jones Business News and Information Services, featuring Dow Vision, a direct-to-desktop customized news service. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comedy was the family business when Ben Stiller was growing up. His parents are the comedy team of Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira. Now Ben Stiller is starring in the film Flirting with Disaster, a comedy about a dysfunctional family, in which Stiller plays an adopted son in search of his birth parents. Stiller directed the 1994 comedy Reality Bites and directed a second film scheduled to open this summer called The Cable Guy, starring Jim Carrey and Matthew Broderick. On this archive edition, we have a 1993 interview recorded when Ben Stiller had his own comedy show on Fox. That show is now being rerun on Comedy Central. The show lampooned MTV, pretentious rock stars, movies, television, commercials, and confessional video journals. In one sketch, Ben Stiller played a Hollywood agent trying to get his clients, Roseanne and Tom Arnold, to make a disease movie.
Let's get serious. Come on, you guys are too good for comedy. I mean, let's do a disease, all right? Tom, you get sick. Rosie, you come and take care of him. Rosie, you get sick. Tom takes care of you. I mean, I don't care. It works both ways. You both get sick, you die, you fall in love, whatever, right? You're the creative ones. You can figure it out.
We're beginning to feel like maybe you're not the right agent for us.
What? This is a bit, right? Doing a thing? I love it. All right, keep going. Come on.
You haven't done crap for us.
All right. Where's the punch? Oh, come on, Rosie. Come on. What do you want? You're number one. Where else can we go?
The show was number one when we hired you.
Whew. This weight loss thing is really playing with your heads, guys. I mean, really, is this the Slim Shake talking? Because if it is, let's go across the street, let's get a cheeseburger, fries, fried chicken, load it up and eat it, because nothing is worth this, all right? Let's face it, the diet is killing your careers. Fat is funny. You go back in time, Greeks, Romans, in the tub, rub-a-dub-lub, three men having fun.
Is this based on an agent that you know?
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, he's my ex-agent.
Oh, really?
In 5 years, I had him, and he wasn't a bad guy. He actually worked really, really hard for me, and this is how I pay him back.
So, is this why he's your ex-agent?
Yeah, it is. He threatened to sue me. Actually, he made me if I made the name too similar to his. All agents have a certain amount of. I don't know what it is, like a kind of a bull factor, I guess. They're always kind of blowing smoke at you, and they talk in circles. And this guy kind of just talks around and around. He'll be pitching horrible ideas. You know, you should do a sitcom. You know, you could be doing a thing with Bea Arthur. You know, it's you and her, and she's, you know, she lives next door, and she's gruff, and you're crazy, but you like her, but you don't like her. And then all of a sudden something happens. You teach each other how to love. It's beautiful, you know? And, you know, he just kind of... They always deal in concepts, you know.
Did you ever try to go along with him on one of these ideas and really get your hopes up that you were going to do this sitcom with Bea Arthur and teach each other how to love?
Yeah, for 5 years. I was he's calling me up with these ideas. And then, when I started directing, he would, call me up with these just things that he'd never, totally untrue. It would be like, you want to direct, he goes, you want to direct Ice Cube's new video? I go, I don't know. You know, I'm like a Jewish kid from New York. You really think he wants me? He goes, I'll talk to him about it. You know, the only thing is you got to go to Compton every day, but you could deal with that, right? meanwhile, he's never even, he never even talked to him. He'd always be throwing out stuff like that. So you know, you learn to kind of not take it too seriously after a while and just kind of take notes so that you can use it down the line on your own show, hopefully, you know.
Is
you
it
can do something productive with it.
Is it hard to break up with an agent? Did you feel very guilty about it?
Yeah, it is, actually. It's really hard because you do develop a close relationship because, you know, an agent has your career in his hands and actors are really insecure and you're kind of always, you know, he's your link to the outside world. He's going to be taking all the offers or auditions that you go on. He gets the feedback and he tells you and he has to kind of sift it through to you without, you know, kind of dealing with that fragile ego that actors have. So he's your link. And if, you know, you develop a bond with him in some way because it's kind of like this codependent relationship that develops, you know, where you really need to, you need the approval and, So when it finally comes time to change, it's like breaking up with a girlfriend or something like that because, you know, there are always aspects that you really like about the person, but you also know that you have to move on. So it's not easy.
Your parents are Jerry Stiller and Mira. No,
that's not them. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, yes.
That's another Stiller.
Right.
No, I'm sorry.
So were there lots of showbiz people around the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, there were. It was kind of, it was a crazy, crazy household. It was Rodney Dangerfield would come over for Thanksgiving. Andy Kaufman came over and have chocolate milk at Passover. Weird things.
When you were growing up, were your parents in the kitchen working out routines?
And yeah, they were in the living room, actually. They were. They had an office in the living room, and they would close the door, and we would hear them working on their... on the routines. My dad had this reel-to-reel tape recorder, I used to love gadgets and stuff, and I just thought he had this great reel-to-reel tape recorder, and I was about 7 or 8, and all I could think of was, when my parents die, I'm going to inherit this tape recorder. That was all I thought that was the coolest thing in the world.
What were you going to do with it?
I was going to make my own tapes and, you know, probably, like, record soundtracks to movies, you know, because I made Super 8 films, and So they would go in there, and they would work on their stuff, and, you know, they'd take us on the road with them when they would go and do Las Vegas or go out to California.
Oh, boy, share with us a memory of being on the road with your parents when they were doing Las Vegas.
Okay, let's see. Well, there was, we spent a lot of time in motels, and I remember my folks, they worked with people like Lola Falana, and, you know, they were, you know, they had their brushes with like Frank Sinatra and people like that. I never met him, but there was also a lot of time hanging out on sets. Like my parents took us on the Partridge Family set in California, and
now was that a thrill or did you think, oh, this is what an absurd show?
No. I was totally into it. You know, I mean, I thought this is you know so cool. Danny Bonaducci was like kind of flirting with my sister, which is funny now in retrospect. But my parents did The Courtship of Eddie's Father. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
And I remember Brandon Cruz, who was Eddie on the show, came up to me, and we were about the same age, and I had this candy bar, and he just knocked it out of my hand, like in this kind of show of his power on the set to kind of just establish who was the boss on the set. And then he walked away from me. I'll never forget that one.
How did you feel?
I felt small. I was just kind of shocked, I think. You know, I didn't know, you know, who this guy was. But, you know, that was kind of tempered by Bobby Brady waving to me from the stagecoach when they were doing the Grand Canyon episode. You know, so, I mean, and that's real. I mean, that's true. So,
making you feel like you were really somebody.
That's right. It kind of brought me back up again.
So, did your friends' parents work in show business too?
I had some. Friends whose parents were in show business, but you know, we grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and it was it's not like a typical environment. It's not like suburbia, and it's not middle America at all. And I think, you know, I never really knew what a normal environment was like. I thought when I finally kind of got out of New York a little bit, I was kind of fascinated by the suburbs. I went to do a movie like 5 years ago in Cincinnati, and I just thought it was the most amazing place in the world, because it was like here are all these like houses that I'd seen in commercials, you know. I started going out with this girl there, and I think I was more into her family, which, you know, they had a dog and she had a little brother, and her father was like Mr. All-American. He'd been in the Air Force, and he played football, and they, you know, it just was like, this is, wow, this is America. And I felt like kind of this, like, little spy, and, you know, kind of seeing what the rest of the country lived like. So it was really an interesting experience for me. So, but it kind of wore off after a while.
When there were showbiz people around the house, would you feel comfortable talking with them?
Yeah, it was, I guess so. I mean, I didn't really consider them showbiz people, though. You know, it was more like they were just my parents' friends. You know, those were the people who they hung out with and who were, and we were around the theater a lot, and we were, you know, that was just kind of our life. So it wasn't like, you know, I remember when my dad did this play Hurley Burley a few years back. I was about, I think, 17 or 18, and that had, like, this cast, like, William Hurt and Sigourney Weaver and Judith Ivey and just, like, you know, Ron Silver, Harvey Keitel. It was just this great cast. And I remember hanging out, you know, at that point we were older, but these were, like, people who were more from, like, you know, movie stars from my generation, you know, who my dad was working with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very kind of exciting for my sister and I at that point because we were kind of young and we were just getting into the business, and you know, to be hanging out with William Hurt. I was, like, you know, a big Altered States fan, and my dad, like, invited him up to our country house, and he went fishing with him. So I'm, like, fishing with William Hurt, and he's really, you are unique. And he's telling me that.
He's telling you.
He was
are
telling
unique.
Me. He was telling me. Yeah, he was really intense. He would just get really intense. The fish aren't biting. And he would just get very intense about whatever he talked about. And so I was just freaking out. I was having a great time.
So now that you have a TV show, when you watch TV, do you see it differently? You know, because as someone who's watched TV a lot all of his life?
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, what I see is just it's really tough to put out a half hour of comedy that you believe in, you know, you think is really funny every week. You have so much to film in such a short amount of time. You're always working against the clock and budget constraints. So it's not easy. You know what's tough, too, is getting on the air. I don't think people understand how tough it is to actually get to a show that's picked up for a series. Like, you know, we developed this show for a couple of years, and, you know, the networks are just, you know, they make a lot of decisions based on demographics and focus groups and all these, you know, factors. And there are so many pilots that are made. And you know, a lot of them stink. And, you know, but there are a lot of good ones, too, I think, that get made and then don't get picked up. So I feel really lucky that we even got to this point where we're on the air.
Are you a survivor of focus groups?
Oh, I went to the focus group for my own show. It was like the war. It was like the surreal high school nightmare to stand behind a two-way mirror and watch people talk about you for 4 hours and criticize you. And all they do is
and
ask...
And who are they?
Who are they? Yeah, well, who are they? That's, you know what? It was the strangest amalgam of, like, you know who they are? They're people, they go to a mall and they say, do you like Herman's Head? And if they say yes, and they say, do you want $35 and a free sandwich? Then that's the criteria. That's it. And then they come up to the room, and then they judge, you know, and they pass judgment, which the network takes very seriously on what you've been working on. You know, you've been, you know, putting your whole life into it. And then these people come in, and you're in the middle. It's in the middle of, you know, your big piece on the show, and they're, like, going over to try to get another carrot stick, you know. And you think, no, just watch it. And they're all different funny types in there, and just they all claim that they don't know anything about. You know, about show business. So they're all like, well, you know, one guy's a mechanic, but then he's saying, you know, I think the protagonist was rather weak in the first act. And they have all got screenplays. You know, it's because they do it, they did ours outside of Los Angeles. So it was, it was pretty wild to sit through that. After that, I thought I could, you know, I feel like I could deal with anything.
Ben Stiller recruited in 1993. He's now starring in the film Flirting with Disaster. We'll hear from the film's director next week. Stiller's comedy show is being rerun on Comedy Central. This is Fresh Air. Ben Stiller's new movie, Flirting with Disaster, is a comedy about a dysfunctional family. The public radio family can become dysfunctional when some listeners don't do their fair share and make a pledge. They just sit back and enjoy the show, confident that other people will pledge enough money to keep the station going. What can save the public radio dysfunctional family? Therapy won't do it. The only cure is making a pledge. Thanks for your support. Thank you. Not many bands these days have saxophones, and fewer still have full brass sections, but there was a time when no self-respecting rock and roll band would be without a honking tenor sax. In the last of our series on the instruments in the classic rock and roll band, Ed Ward salutes some forgotten titans of the saxophone.
The saxophone was present at the birth of rock and roll, although it's pretty much absent today. In fact, in rhythm and blues, the saxophone was practically the dominant instrument, starting with Louis Jordan in the 30s. Jordan played alto and sang, and although not many who followed in the genre he all but created did the same, he established the sax as a necessary part of a hep combo. In fact, rhythm and blues became a haven for saxophonists who supposedly weren't good enough for jazz. R&B was seen as jazz's poor step cousin, no matter that by 1950 it was outselling jazz 10-1. Still, it can't be denied that rhythm and blues saxophone was more about show than skill a lot of the time. Like Chuck Higgins' Pachuco Hop were more geared towards heading to a screaming climax, often with the player on his knees, on his back, or walking carefully among the drinks on the bar. As swing-oriented rhythm and blues gave way to more modern sounds, the saxophone solo remained sacrosanct. It was always there in the middle of the record. Well, not but my real name is there. As music, it was usually a throwaway, but some of the very best players could somehow find a way to raise the energy level in the few seconds allotted them. Allen, the New Orleans sax player who played on more classics than anyone can remember, was definitely one of them. Most sax players were anonymous, often by choice. There are persistent rumors that Ornette Coleman played several L.A.-based rhythm and blues sessions, and other jazzers took these gigs on occasion for money. Others set out to make a name for themselves.
You just put on your coat and hat and walk yourself to the laundromat.
Don't hold back.
Curtis Owsley, better known as King Curtis, had an instantly recognizable sound on alto and tenor sax and parlayed it into a long series of hits well after the sax-led combo had vanished from the charts. Thank you. As session man of choice on scores of Atlantic soul hits, he was one of the few high-profile saxophonists of the era, the only one besides James Brown's saxophonist Maceo Parker, whose name was recognized by fans. In fact, by the mid-60s, the emphasis was more on a brass section rather than a sax solo.
One month from the day I first met you, your promises proved to be untrue. So step by step, I've been a fool. Now I'm just two steps from the blue.
Inspired by such pioneers as trumpeter Joe Scott, who arranged Bobby Bland's material, in-house horn sections like the Marquise and the Memphis Horns rated high enough to make their own records and occasionally get their names in small type on other performers' singles. But in the wake of the cutback in forces that guitar-oriented rock had introduced, such niceties were often lumped with string sections in what producers referred to as sweetening, as if it were frosting on a cake that was already delicious without it. As the 70s dawned, horrendous horn-heavy rock bands like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Chicago came on the scene and turned the tables with their parody of what classic soul studio musicians did effortlessly. After that, the classic R&B brass sound was found mostly in roots bands, one of whom, the Blasters, had the good taste to bring Lee Allen out of retirement for a few years before his death. Mostly, though, it's a way of pointing to the past. It's a shame. Those anonymous players occasionally laid down some hot licks. It's not impossible. There's some more waiting in the wings.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. Our series on the instruments of the rock and roll band was produced by Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, William Link. He was inducted into the TV Hall of Fame last night. He co-created Mannix, Murder, She Wrote, and Columbo. And we'll hear from the star of Columbo, Peter Falk.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, William Link was inducted into the Television Hall of Fame. He co-created 14 TV series, including Murder, She Wrote, Mannix, and Columbo. We'll hear from Peter Falk, the star of Columbo, in a few minutes. Throughout Link's TV career, he's alternated between writing mysteries and made-for-TV movies about social issues. The Execution of Private Slovic was the story of an army deserter. That Certain Summer starred Hal Holbrook as a divorced man who comes out as a homosexual. And Terrorism on Trial was about an Arab terrorist extradited to the U.S. where he's defended by a Jewish lawyer. William Link worked with his partner Richard Levinson until Levinson's death in 1987. On this archive edition, we have an excerpt of our 1989 interview with Link. Link and Levinson pioneered the TV movie social drama. Link told me that the first one they did, My Sweet Charlie, was about racism.
We got thrown into the deep end of the pool. We were sent to Galveston, Texas, and it was a racial movie which didn't sit too well with the denizens of the Gulf Coast. And it really was our baptism of fire. It was very, very successful. Probably My Sweet Charlie is considered the first television movie that proved you didn't have to do all car chases and private eyes.
Well, what was the hardest part of that movie to talk the network into? What did they object to anything?
Yes, they objected to that you had a young white woman and an older black man together alone in a bungalow on the Gulf Coast. They were very leery of even of us hinting at any romantic entanglement. Those were the 60s. Networks do not have that problem anymore.
Now, you did one of the first docudramas, The Execution of Private Slovic.
Yes.
Which was...
That was our favorite movie. And still
was it?
Yeah.
Tell briefly the storyline.
Eddie Slovic was the first American GI since the Civil War who was executed for desertion. And the story really explores his character and the military justice or lack of same in the armed forces during the Second World War.
Now, since this was based on a real story...
Oh, yes.
Were there legal complications that you had to deal with?
No. We bought the book by William Bradford Huey, The Execution of Private Slovic. We owned that because we bought the rights from Frank Sinatra. Sinatra wanted to film it as a motion picture years before, but he got into a lot of trouble because it was about an army deserter, and the Hearst Press really took after him, Hedda Hopper, et cetera. He wanted Steve McQueen, who was a very young actor, to play Slovic. And then he made a mistake in those days of hiring a blacklisted writer, Albert Maltz, to write the screenplay. And that was the end. And he capitulated and took ads in the New York Times and various other newspapers saying that the American public had spoken. Actually, the Hearst Press had spoken. And he decided not to do the picture. Every year, Dick Levinson and I called his attorney in Hollywood saying, can we buy the rights from Mr. Sinatra? And finally, 1 year we called and we found out, much to our chagrin, that he had sold the rights to a New York commercial filmmaker. And we made a deal with him, acquired the rights, and made the picture with Martin Sheen.
I remember the story from your book, Stay Tuned, that your big fear was that at the end of The Execution of Private Slovic, after the execution, that the credits would be rolling and Ed McMahon's voice would come on.
Yes.
Promoting the Johnny Carson
That's
show.
And yes.
The whole spell would be broken.
Well, we called the president of NBC, and he pulled some strings, and Ed McMahon was silent that evening. Except what happened was is that, as some of the engineers are sometimes prone to do, since we had no music score per se, no dramatic score in the picture, they turned up the wind at the end. We just had a low, raw wind in the background as they carried out the coffin. It became a full-fledged gale, a hurricane, but there was nothing we could do.
Talking about television with William Link, who has written and produced many series as well as made-for-TV movies. Tell us how you created the character of Columbo.
Columbo was originally born in 1960 in Hollywood, and one of the brand new color shows on NBC called The Chevrolet Mystery Show was a summer replacement for Dinah Shore. And we wrote an hour suspense drama in which we introduced a cigar-chomping, rain-coated detective. It was originally played by Bert Fried on that show. It was a one-shot, and it was successful. Then we got the idea of doing it as a stage play. And then Dick and I were astonished because the character of Columbo in the play was really a secondary character. But he always got the greatest applause at the end, and people seemed to pick up on him. It was then that Universal approached us to doing it as a two-hour movie for television. That was in the very, very early halcyon days of the movie for television, actually the very beginning. It was extremely successful. It was one of the top shows of the week, and then NBC said, well, let's do this as an hour show with Peter Falk. Luckily for us, Peter did not want to do an hour show. 22 one-hour segments he found much too constricting. And also, we could never do Columbo as an hour show. It's impossible, because you need a whole half an hour to set up the perfect crime that the brilliant murderer indulges in. But that's really the history of Columbo.
Now, the actors you originally used were considerably older than Peter Falk was when
yes.
he was cast as Columbo.
Yes. Dick and I, proving how crazy we were, our first choice was Bing Crosby. And we contacted his agent and contacted Bing, but he wanted to play golf. He did not want to return. I mean, he was in his mansion in Hillsborough outside of San Francisco. And Peter Falk we had known socially for many years in New York when he was a struggling young actor. He didn't struggle that long. And he did his first movie in which he was nominated for an Academy Award. And he somehow got hold of a script, as actors do in Hollywood, called us and said, I will kill to play this cop. And we said, well, you know, he's a little young, but he's got that rough-hewn, that New Yorkish, that very down-to-earth demeanor. And he did it.
Was that mumbly quality something you wrote into the script or something he just brought with him?
No, Peter brought that quality. Everything else was in the stage play. The raincoat, the cigar, you see the murderer do the dirty deed, enter the cop who appears to be somewhat of a schlub. Actually, you know, that outward shoddy facade hides this brilliant computer brain. All that was in the stage play. Peter brought the humanity to it, and a lot of the humor.
William Link recorded in 1989. Last night, he was inducted into the TV Hall of Fame. We'll hear from Peter Falk, the star of Columbo, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Peter Falk is known to TV viewers around the world as Columbo, the disheveled detective Falk has played on and off since 1971. In film, he's perhaps most highly regarded for his work with director John Cassavetes in such movies as Husbands and A Woman Under the Influence. On stage, he won a Tony Award for his performance in Neil Simon's Prisoner of Second Avenue. I spoke with Peter Falk last year and asked him what the part of Columbo was like when he first read it.
It was very good. It was somebody that I immediately wanted to play. But the basic thrust of a guy appearing less than he actually is, that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And that disarming quality of not ever appearing formidable was always there. I think that when we started to make the series, they would often write scenes that were supposed to be humorous. And those are the ones that made me very, very nervous.
Why?
Because I didn't think they were funny. They were kind of cute. And so I would tamper with those all the time to make sure that they were funny, that they were humorous, not funny, and that they were more subtle and more believable. And the other thing that I guess I insisted upon was that I think that he is by birth a polite man, but he's also canny. So he's not above using his politeness. But the fact that he is polite makes it easier for him to play polite. And the other thing that used to bother me about the early scripts, not the early scripts, any of the scripts, was in the final scene, if you had what actors used to refer to as Moshe the Explainer scenes. That's when the detective, he takes two pages, he talks for two pages and he explains everything that happened. And as the actor, you can hear the people snoring. You know the audience is tuned out, they're not interested. So the trick is to have that final scene remain a scene and have the cat and mouse going back and forth, and the audience plus the villain, they don't know what in the hell this guy's driving at, but they're interested. You show them just enough to keep them interested, keep them guessing what is he going to do. And when you finally nail the guy, that should be the end of the show. It should be about three lines after that, and that's it. It was things like that that used to... And clues. The clues can't be transparent. And if they're obvious to the audience, then he's not Sherlock Holmes.
I like the way you described Columbo as looking like less than he actually is. That's something that's easy to identify with. Did you identify with that?
I've always been sloppy all my life. I never could keep myself together. And I am in person a bit misty. I can't keep an umbrella more than 3 days. That was when I used to live in New York. You'd lose it and lose everything. And frequently walk in the walls. So I understood that quality. And I am a slow thinker. Attracted to ambiguity. I'm not somebody that has black and white answers to everything. And that kind of fits in with Columbo. So the slowness and the methodicalness and the sloppiness, that was all very easy for me.
And of course, I should ask you about the raincoat. Columbo's raincoat, which I believe you bought.
Mm. Well, there was a dispute over that because I...
What, over who really bought it?
No, the dispute was... I always said that I read that in the script, but Lincoln Levinson said, no, it wasn't in the script. But I seem to remember seeing it in the script, so whatever it is. I did buy it, but I didn't buy it at the time. I had already had it, but I said, this is what I want to wear. And I knew what I wanted to wear underneath it, too. I wanted everything to be tan and brown altogether. A little dash of dull green in the tie. And that's about as flashy as he got. And the suit that fitted me the least was a seersucker, kind of seersucker blue and white. So I said, dye that. And they dyed it and got out all that white, whatever the hell it was, I don't remember. But it had to be dyed, and that became tan. And the shoes were mine, too. They were a pair of shoes I picked up in Italy, I don't know, a long time ago. They happened to be fairly expensive shoes, handmade shoes, but they were very comfortable. and they were clunky.
And that was important, clunky?
Clunky was important, yeah.
For that sense of being slightly uncoordinated?
I think he always wanted that contrast because the people that he was going after, they were always...
wealthy.
They were always, yes, God's chosen. I mean, they all had long necks, and they all could buy suits off the rack, and it fitted them, and they looked good, and their teeth were white, and they had dough, and they spoke well, and so... Clunky shoes are a good contrast.
I have one more Columbo question for you. Do you think that your long association with that character has worked for you, against you, both in the other part of your career, the part outside of Columbo?
Well, I always say the same thing, Terry.
Say it again.
I'll say it again. Being known as Columbo, and it ain't cancer. So, I mean, I make a lot of dough, and the listeners, you know, I think it's difficult for the average person to say, what's he complaining about that he's typecast? Who the hell cares? I mean, he does make a lot of money, and he gets good seats in restaurants, and so I don't feel that that's something that people are really interested in. But to answer your question, I think arguably I probably would be a better actor if I hadn't spent so much time playing that one role. I think that kind of diversity and that kind of challenge, I might be a better actor. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think probably I would be, but so what?
I want to ask you, you have a glass eye, and I think that happened when you were three. You had a tumor removed.
Yeah.
And I guess they removed your eye, too?
It was a malignant tumor.
Do you think that that you've made that work for you as an actor to affect your image, to use it as something that looked menacing or that made you look more vulnerable?
Well, none of that was consciously. I mean, the only thing that I would be aware of when I was acting was a try to avoid looking 100% wall-eyed. I mean, so that if you were to look in one direction and one eye went all the way to the left and the other one was still in the middle, I try to avoid that. But I have never consciously felt that, though I'll use it in some way.
Gee, could you not get shot from certain angles because your eye wouldn't move and that would be the only eye on camera?
I'm better off from the left side. I think that minimizes the wall-eyed thing.
Mm-hmm. Did kids pay you to look? You know how kids are.
That would have been good. No, they never did that. Now, when you were a kid, you know, I used to dread that moment when somebody would say, "What's the matter with your eye?" or something like that. And there was a turning point, I don't know, when I was 12 or 13 years old. I think it had to do more with playing ball with the guys, because once you started knocking around with those guys... they were so open about it, and they would say it so freely, and it was usually a gag or a joke or knocking you or whatever the hell it is, that by then it didn't mean anything to me anymore. I was very comfortable with it.
Did it interfere with
it? Because I realized, yeah. The other thing is, then I realized I could get a laugh with it.
No, did it interfere with anything that you wanted to do?
No, not at all. No, I think one of the main problems with the eye was the fact that my mother would, if I'd go play football or whatever sport, she was always nervous about it. And I always thought that was ridiculous, nothing to be nervous about. You know, when you're that age, nothing can happen to you. You could always get people's attention if you took a spoon and tapped it.
Oh, gosh.
Well, the first night, I remember the first night I was in a Merchant Marine. There was this black guy from San Francisco. I think he was from Oakland. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. We just had shared this forecastle together for the first night, and... he was sitting up in the top bunk opposite me, and I came in and I sat down. It was already very, very late, and he had his pajamas on. So I started getting undressed. At that time, I had my front teeth were knocked out. and I had a removable bridge. So I took out that bridge and put it on the table. It had a nice sound effect, a little clunk when that went down. And then I popped the eye out, and then the glass hit the tabletop. That had a nice sound effect. And he's up there. He's up there watching me. And then I bent over, and I started unscrewing my knee. It was a gesture, you know, where I started turning it. And it looked like I was about to remove my leg. And I'll never, I always remember him saying, "Excuse me, I'll be right back." He went somewhere, probably the men's room.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, you're very welcome.
Peter Falk recorded last year. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. Public radio stations around the country are fundraising this week. Let me give one perhaps slightly self-serving reason for asking you to pledge now. Fresh Air needs your support to continue. Each station that carries the show pays a fee, and that fee goes toward our production budget. That's the way it works with most national shows. Now, your station needs Fresh Air listeners to call and pledge, or else your station won't raise enough money to keep Fresh Air on the air. So if you want to keep listening, you know what you have to do. Thank you so much for your support. A new album by the Fugees called The Score is one of the season's surprise hits. This second album by an obscure hip-hop act from New Jersey is pushing Mariah Carey off the top of the charts. Its music ranges from hardcore rap to a cover of Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. Rock critic Ken Tucker explores the range of this group.
Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and take it slowly. Ready or not, here I come, you can't hide. Gonna find you and make you want me.
Now that I escape, sleep, walk, awake. Those who correlate know the world ain't kick. Jail bars ain't golden gates. Those who fake, they break. When they meet their 400-pound mate, if I could rule the world.
At a certain point listening to The Score, I started jotting down all the names and pop cultural references that the Fugees were using to make their musical points. Alec Baldwin, Newt Gingrich, Dick Van Dyke, Last Tango in Paris, Tracy Chapman, Mussolini, Carlos Santana, and the Star Wars missile system all get invoked, and not just as a matter of cutesy name-dropping. The Fugees deploy pop culture to complete their rhymes, but also to summon up a society filled with superficial entertainment and threatening political enemies.
Warn the town, the beast is loose.
Word them up, y'all.
Warn the town, the beast is loose.
Come on.
Conflicts with nightsticks, illegal sales districts, handpicked lunatics, keep all the trictions rich, heretics. Push narcotics amidst its risks and frisks. Cool clicks, throw bricks, but seldom get targets. Private dicks sell hits like porno flicks to chicks. The 666 cut wick like Newt Gingrich.
Meanwhile, the government brings Star Wars.
The Fugees have perfected a kind of loping beat that tempers the tone of their gangster rap style. This trio from New Jersey, who met while going to high school, are in hip-hop terms as hard and street as any gangsta, but they also have a fierce fondness for real melodies. I like very much, for example, the way they use the Flamingos' 1959 doo-wop ballad, I Only Have Eyes for You, as an entry point to their own concerns.
One, two, I'm about to set this off like this. Hip-hoppers, check it. Another MC loses life tonight, Lord. I beg not you pray to Jesus Christ. Why? Oh Lord, Father, don't let him bury me. Whoa. I haunt MCs like
like Mephistopheles, yeah. Bringing swords to Damocles. Secret service keeper close watches if my name was Kennedy. Abstract rap, simple with this street format. Gaze into the sky and measure planets by parallax. Check out the retrograde motion, kill the notion of biting and recycling and calling it your own creation. Feel like Rockwell, somebody's watching me. I got no privacy, whether on land or at sea. And for your biting zealots, your rap's an alpha. I think if a prick predict, but deep inside you wish you had the pop hit. It hurts, don't it? A refugee come to your turf. Take over the earth.
Yeah. The Fugees take their name from the word refugees, a gesture of solidarity with the Haitian refugees who were much in the news when the group formed a few years ago. The Fugees' most striking asset is the cool, serene voice of Lauryn Hill. Hill was asked in a recent interview to name the Fugees' chief influences. She said they were Machiavelli, Hobbes, and Locke. Oh, yeah, and Roberta Flack.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
I think one reason the Fugees are burning up the charts is that hip-hop is just now reaching a long overdue crossroads. The profane thriller scenarios that filled so much of this genre have become exhausted and trite at a time when the music has become more interesting, more dense, complicated, and elusive. The Fugees are here to help reconnect the words and music in fresh, provocative ways.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Score, a new album by the Fugees. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our archive show is produced today by Roberta Shirock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo, how many mics do we rip on the deli? Semi say mini money, semi say many, many, many. How many mics do we rip on the deli? Mini money, semi say many, many, many.
I get mad frustrated when I rhyme. Thinking of all them kids that try to do this for all the wrong reasons. Seasons change, mad things rearrange, but it all stays the same like the love Doctor Strange. I'm tame like the rapper. Get red like a snapper when they do that. Got your whole block saying true that. If only they knew that. It was you who was irregular. Sold your soul for some secular music that's whack. Plus you use that loop over and over, claiming that you got a new style. Your attempts are futile. Ooh, child, you're puerile. Brainwaves are sterile. You can't create. You just wait to take my tape. Laced with malice, hands get callous from ripping microphones from here to Dallas. Go ask Alice if you don't believe me. I get inner visions like Steve.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.